I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the medium that globalized conversation and commerce. The modern miracle known as the internet is full to bursting these days with mischief, anxiety, strife. Cyber insecurity is the label touching voting machines in the presidential race and your email, highlighting the leaky joints of a jerry-built web. Is there a case this hour for Internet 2, a redesign? And in the loose talk about cyber as the new warfare that can turn great cities dark at the flick of a switch, what must we all know about the cyber warfare that's already begun? Alex Gibney gets us started. A decorated documentarian at intersections of secrecy and power, Enron, Scientology, WikiLeaks before this. His new thriller is an ominous account of the first cyber war waged against Iran with a weaponized computer virus known as Stuxnet. The movie's title is Zero Days.
We didn't know if there was a deadline coming up where this threat would trigger and suddenly would like turn off all, you know, electricity plants around the world, or it would start shutting things down or launching some attack. We knew that Stuxnet could have very dire consequences, and we were very worried about what the payload contained, and there was an imperative speed that we had to race and try and, you know, beat this ticking bomb.
Basically, what happened was that the U.S. and Israel jointly decided to invent a new kind of weapon, and this was a cyber weapon, that is to say a digital weapon, that would infect the programmable logic computers, PLCs, in the nuclear centrifuges in Natanz, where Iran was enriching uranium. And the idea was that they would infect the controllers of those centrifuges and make them blow up, effectively. But they'd make them blow up in ways which would be hidden from the Iranian scientists. And that may be the underappreciated but most brilliant part of the weapon, that left no fingerprints. So the Iranian scientists, at least initially, thought that they were the ones who were screwing up, that they just couldn't get this stuff right. But in fact, what had happened was that their machines had been taken over by a computer virus that was literally instructing the centrifuges to blow up. It's the first time that a cyber weapon or a cyber attack crossed the threshold from cyberspace into the physical realm.
And it turned out it was traceable.
It turned out it was traceable because the Israelis, under pressure from Benjamin Netanyahu, got a little bit too aggressive. They wanted to blow up too many centrifuges too quickly. While it was a joint weapon, they manipulated the code on their own and in so doing created flaws in it, and also allowed it to spread far more aggressively than it ever had done in the past. And it's a myth to think that it spread out of Natanz. They actually, in order to try to get it into Natanz, created a virus that would spread through the IT community in Iran, but in so doing, it spread literally all over the world, including into the United States, and was discovered by an IT firm in Belarus who was engaged by Iranians who wanted to know why their computers were shutting down.
Mm. Alex Gibney, the strange part is this is a famous fiasco now, well documented. You've done a movie about it, and the government still won't say anything. What is the problem here?
What is the problem is a good question. I mean, it would be a little bit like Harry Truman saying after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what bombs?
Right.
The obsession with secrecy, which has become really destructive and pernicious, has now entered a kind of Alice in Wonderland quality where the governments of the U.S. and Israel can't even admit to things that we know to be palpably true.
Compare it in your own terms to the historic event of Hiroshima, Nagasaki.
What makes Stuxnet comparable to the first use of atomic weapons is that Stuxnet was a kind of a patient zero of a new kind of weapon. It marked a new generation of weapons. And once that weapon is out of the box, it can't be put back in. So they seem very easy to use. They seem banal. But in the physical world, they can have terrifying impact. And it's both the initial banality and the terrifying impact in combination that gives them a new kind of look and feel that represents the same kind of departure that nuclear weapons were from conventional explosives.
Impact and blowback, too.
That's right. Stuxnet was the first experiment that we know of. So much of this is secret. The first experiment that we know of in terms of crossing the threshold from the cyber to the physical world. In just a few years after Stuxnet, the United States, possibly as a way of ensuring that Iran wouldn't cheat on its nuclear agreement with the Obama administration, devised a much bigger generation or a much bigger series of weapons that was disclosed for the first time through our film called Nitro Zeus. And Nitro Zeus was an operation in which we, the United States, was able to infect a vast number of computer systems in Iran, tied to military installations and their ability to fight back, but also tied to key electrical grids. And at the flick of a switch or a few switches, we have been able to shut these down, whether it would have been their radar, their missiles, their electrical grids, which also supply the power to hospitals. We would have been able to effectively, as I understand it, shut down most of the country.
What would have happened, in your view, Alex, if those viruses had been aimed at our computers or our technology or our electrical grids or Israel's for that matter?
Well, I think they would have been perceived as an act of war. You know, an attack on critical infrastructure can be considered to be an act of war. Now, in the context of U.S.-Israeli relations and Israeli-Iranian relations, I think President Bush at the time, and then later on President Obama, concluded that it would be better to play a delaying action than to allow Israel to bomb Iran, which is what Israel was threatening to do, which would inevitably have drawn us into a war with Iran. So it was done within that context, but I think it's also fair to say that it set a very ugly precedent going forward, because it meant that we thought that we could do something like that with impunity. Well, others, I think, would feel righteous doing it to us. And we're already seeing other examples of this popping up very recently. I believe it was at the end of last year, the Russians shut down a portion of the Ukrainian grid with a cyber weapon. And so the kind of sci-fi scenarios of how these cyber weapons are literally either making things blow up or shutting down huge portions of what we consider to be modern life are now coming true.
The U.S. still thinks it has the best weapons and has used them maybe more than anybody else. What's the chance that China or somebody has a Nitro Zeus aimed at us?
I think the chance is actually reasonably good. We don't know how effective it would be, but we do know that the Chinese and the Russians have implants in the United States. That is to say, sleeping computer viruses, which are due to go off at some time in the future if they so choose. We know that because we have those same things in Russia and in China and in other countries around the world. And that's why with the kind of danger of a sort of escalating cyber battle turning into a war, again, without proper understanding of who might have fired the first shot or where it was coming from, the secrecy surrounding this stuff is so painful because it's allowing the possibility of something very bad to happen because nobody is discussing it because it's all supposed to be secret.
We hear people say, no, this is just espionage, not to be confused with a military operation or an invasion, but it would be nice to draw the line, you know, which is which.
Well, it is espionage in a sense. I mean, I think that these weapons grow out of espionage. They're fired from the National Security Agency or its equivalent, Unit 8200 in Israel. And they are originally espionage tools, the idea of breaking into networks to spy on people. But as Michael Hayden, former head of the NSA and the CIA, told us, you know, it's already part of the package then, that once you spy on somebody, you can then attack that same network and make physical items now blow up. So it started in espionage, but now it's morphed into a new generation of weapons. We just got the very smallest hint that the U.S. was beginning to be willing to talk about cyber weapons when Admiral Rogers, who took over from Keith Alexander at the NSA, admitted that we were using cyber weapons against ISIS. And we now know that when it comes to things like email communications, the U.S. at least, and we presume then China and Russia, have now the ability to literally intercept emails en route to its intended addressee and change the message, which is a scary idea whenever you're typing something into your computer. So the future is murky because we're surrounded by so much secrecy that's really interfering with the fundamental nature of what a democracy should be.
Speak of three main dangers on your worry list.
Worry number one is secrecy and what happens that passes through us all the time. How much are we being spied on? What is that information being used for? And why can't we talk about what our governments are supposed to be doing? Two is the worry about weapons that can't be traced back to the people who launched them, because attribution is terribly, terribly hard. And that is a deep concern because it represents the possibility for an extremely destabilized world. And the last concern is more of a prosaic concern, but it's more of a kind of everyday concern. And that is, in our attempt to be interconnected all the time, we've become kind of slaves to that interconnection in ways that are probably going to change our physical appearance, as our necks are going to begin to crane over because we're constantly looking at devices all the time. You know, it was supposed to be, you know, Steve Jobs imagined that the computer would be like a bicycle, the personal computer would be like a bicycle and give rise to the mind and to a new productivity in the mind, the same way a bicycle would improve physical productivity. And I think that was true. But I think what it's also doing is creating a phenomenon where we're very much alone together. We're losing touch with a certain essential humanness because we seem to be so fond of communicating through machines.
Stuxnet reminded Alex Gibney of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 1945. His movie, Zero Days, could remind you of Peter Sellers' Dr. Strangelove, teaching us how to stop worrying and love the bomb back in 1964.
How is it possible for this thing to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to untrigger?
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Gee, I wish we had one of them doomsday machines, Stacy.
Coming up, the go-to Harvard authority, Jonathan Zittrain, who wrote the book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. That was 7 years ago. This is Open Source. Law professor Jonathan Zittrain got his first movie speaking part this summer in Werner Herzog's scan of the internet called Lo and Behold. 20 years ago, Jonathan, you were showing me around the young web in this WBUR studio. You don't like all this war talk or the war metaphors around cyber world emerging. What do you call it?
Well, I agree it's an insecure web, but I worry about using the war metaphor, or as Alex was doing it, thinking of it literally as war, comparing it directly to something like Hiroshima. And it's true that as the internet goes out of just movement of bits and in towards physical space, there are drones flying around thanks to the internet, civilian drones too. We're controlling all sorts of things with them, including our automobiles as those go autonomous. You could see the sorts of scenarios that used to just be the province of screenwriters as they wrote things like Die Hard with a Vengeance, and we saw Hollywood's version of cyber war. That might come into reality. But my worry about the use of war as our frame is that if we're thinking war, we're thinking government. If there's going to be a war, it's not as if we're going to band together in a community group and fight back. And that means thinking of defense in this war as coming from government quarters. And we're in a really interesting zone right now where the job of the National Security Agency is it thinks about what it calls information assurance. That's sort of the defense side of a war, if it were in cyberspace. The NSA is really only there to protect government and military interests and points of presence on the internet. They don't really even have what you'd call the remit or the mandate to protect so-called civilian infrastructure. And I would not like to see a militarization of the defense of the entire net. I don't think that's healthy for the net.
On the matter of militarization, stand by for Richard Clark here. He was the counterterrorism chief who sounded Al-Qaeda alarms in George Bush's White House and was infamously ignored. He told me this week that he's been worried even longer about cyber threats of a very different order. He didn't hesitate to confirm, though, the argument in Alex Gibney's film that the United States let the cyber war genie out of the bottle with the Stuxnet computer worms aimed at Iran?
I think the United States was probably the first nation to conduct an attack that would qualify as a cyber war attack. Stuxnet appears to have been a United States government attack designed to physically destroy objects in the real world, not in cyberspace. And I believe it damaged or destroyed about 800 nuclear centrifuges in Iran. That really was, in many people's eyes, the crossing of the Rubicon. There are probably 24 nations that have cyber military units with both offense and defensive missions, but I can't tell that there was an offensive mission that someone actually did that destroyed something in the real world before Stuxnet. I think the United States is deterred, or should be deterred, from engaging in a large-scale cyber war because we are so vulnerable. Imagine the Patriots, you know, having the great offense with Tom Brady and everything, and then having the defense of the Cleveland Browns. The United States has a great offense, but we have, for a variety of structural reasons, a very little ability to defend the United States from cyber attack.
What is the psychological game going on here? It sounds a little bit like mutually assured destruction gone digital, maybe digitally assured destruction. But what is the signaling back and forth?
Mutually assured destruction was a nuclear war doctrine that, appropriately enough, was called MAD, mutually assured destruction.
From MAD to DAD, that's what we're wondering about.
So MAD was a little crazy, but what it said was, if you use nuclear weapons on me, I'll use nuclear weapons on you. And we both know what that means because we've seen what a nuclear bomb looks like when it goes off. We know how many I have. You know that if you mess with me with nuclear weapons,
you're over.
The world's over. We're not in that situation with cyber weapons because no one really knows how well they work. No one really knows how strong the other guy's weapons are. We don't even know how strong our weapons are. If the president turned to Cyber Command today and said, turn out the lights in Moscow, that may or may not happen. I don't know. Maybe they do. But it's very hard to deter an enemy when the enemy doesn't know what you can do because you've never done it.
On the scale of your anxiety before 9/11, Richard Clark, the warnings that weren't heard, where are you today on the cyber nightmare?
Well, I've been concerned for at least as long as I've been concerned about Al-Qaeda, but it doesn't get to the same level because, frankly, people don't die in cyber attacks, at least not yet. It's conceivable to imagine people dying if the power goes out or something like that. But I don't think we're going to have a full-scale cyber war, perhaps ever. We might, only if nations choose to go to war for other reasons. What bothers me is when the sophisticated tools dribble down from nation states into the hands of non-state actors, be they criminal cartels or terrorist groups. And that's beginning to happen.
Until recently, we thought this was a game of big states, Russia, China, us, etc., and not, you know, the lonely terrorists. Has that changed?
We haven't seen terrorists doing sophisticated things yet with cyber attack, but we have seen criminal cartels getting very, very sophisticated. These people are making billions of dollars. And so they're able to hire engineers, particularly in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, hire engineers, hire mathematicians, and they're doing attacks that, frankly, only nation states could do 5-10 years ago.
Interesting. Who can you imagine is ready to join and honor a Geneva Convention on cyber war?
Well, we have something called the Budapest Convention on cyber crime. And don't hold me to this number, but I think about 80 countries have signed up to that, including us, not including some big players, however, like Russia, China. I think Japan even hasn't.
Does the cyber scene need a cyber peace movement?
Oh, yeah, very much I think it does.
Richard Clark told us, by the by, that North Korea got so hard up for dollars not so long ago that it sent a cyber team out to drill a hole in the SWIFT banking network and hacked their way in. That is the new vulnerability. John Zittrain, law professor, internet pioneer. Who is it that wants to get our attention with these war drums in cyberspace?
Well, I think that first, just going back to the metaphor that Richard Clark was talking about of mutual assured destruction, it's interesting for those who remember the Cold War, it was important to keep the balance of terror, as it were, by not allowing either side to have good enough missile defense. There'd be treaties saying we won't defend ourselves very well because that could cause another country to be tempted to do a preemptive strike or something.
That's his point about Tom Brady's on both sides.
Exactly. And I think in the internet realm, that is even less stable because we have an opportunity to take an internet of 1995, of 2000, and make it more secure, possibly by making it more secure for everyone, which would mean blunting our own offensive weapons. But I think we might want to take that leap of faith that says that if we can create an internet that is not going to be readily brought down even by state actors or by the terrorists or other smaller groups that are learning, they're going up the learning curve, so they're going to get, quote, nuclear weapons cyberwise soon. Creating that secure internet should be one of the highest priorities of our government and of anybody else who wants to see the internet thrive.
Jonathan, you've been saying as long as I've known you that the whole internet is a kind of accident, a kind of Rube Goldberg delight designed by 11 committees built to break down. First of all, how could it have happened? And then an inventory, please, in your order of the real afflictions.
Well, the short story of how it was able to happen is that it happened while most people in a position to want to shape it institutionally weren't paying any attention.
I suppose including the Pentagon from the beginning, right?
Exactly. Now, the Pentagon was perhaps through the National Science Foundation and through DARPA, its arm of research funding, was providing funding for research on networks, but they were not thinking this was going to be so totalizing as a network that, boy, they'd better solve up ahead of time problems of identifying everybody on it, making sure there was no crime. None of that was on anybody's mind so much in 1970, 1980, when the cement was being poured for the internet we have now, an internet that's now very hard to change. It's a victim of its own success in that sense. And I think it was great historical accident that it was able to do a lot of its maturation out of the spotlight. And now that it's in the spotlight, if we were to do it over again, you can imagine the powers that be would not be excited about replicating what we have.
So now speak to the China hacks, the Russia hacks, the leaks, the what sounds like an unsavory Yahoo connection on surveillance with the NSA, the PRISM surveillance record at NSA. So many complaints bursting now into the news every day, including the NSA, what sounds like taking home the most powerful secrets in the world. Put them in your order, including secrecy that Alex Gibney was speaking about.
Well, there's such an interesting conflation going on in that in some ways, surely there's been too much secrecy. Pretty much everybody agrees with that. It's just it's hard to find one responsible human ready to tear aside big chunks of the scrim that might be well to do that. But there's this conflation because when you have leaks and whistleblowing, that's going to entail some piercing of the secrecy, some access to information that the public will see that maybe, in the ideal, promotes accountability. On the other hand, the kind of hacking you see where Colin Powell, private citizen, former Secretary of State, has his Gmail account hacked for 2 years' worth of his email, including the fact that you know his assistant is going to book club and is running a little bit late. I think we, at our peril, celebrate that. We've become.
You celebrate which part?
Celebrate, oh, look at that. Colin Powell is having all his email exposed.
I just wish we could have read his email back when he was selling the Iraq war at the UN.
Well, and it's funny because we're supposed to have mechanisms for that. We actually have a FOIA that ought to be amped up, a Freedom of Information Act, so that we can get to official government correspondence. That's correspondence on behalf of the public that we do have a right to, and even classified stuff is ultimately supposed to be declassified. And there's all sorts of problems with that. But what I worry is in our quest for transparency there, that becomes a quest for transparency anywhere. And we end up cheering on, in this case, in a site called DC Leaks. There was a White House junior aide on an advance team that had his personal Gmail hacked so you could read his emails back and forth with his former fraternity brothers. And that, to me, becomes such an invasion of privacy that it is not freeing us. It's making all of us resigned about our own privacy and complacent about the invasions of privacy of others.
What about the invasion of our political campaign? The people who seem to know, Richard Clark, for example, say without any question the Russians are doing a lot of this stuff, maybe with Putin's own fingerprints on it, and they don't rule out that in this election, when there will be Diebold or other electronic vote counters that leave no paper record, you couldn't go back and prove that you voted for X or Y, that we're our whole game, our pride is in danger.
And we're vulnerable there for the most banal reasons. It turns out to be a story about contractors for the government not wanting too much scrutiny on their municipal deals to provide voting machines, so they keep secret how the machines work. The machines turn out to be poorly coded. They have real problems with them. And then they can be exploited, or the tallying system can be put into question. And for somebody really wanting to make trouble, they don't have to change votes. They just have to make us doubt whether the votes we see are accurate ones.
I mean, just imagine it. Four states come in on Wednesday, and the votes aren't there.
Oh, it's
and it's not just Chad's. They're gone. Four critical states, and Putin is pictured smirking somewhere.
And those who have been pushing for better voting machine security have this kind of, I've been telling you this for 15 years attitude. And they've got solutions in their pockets. There's things like a voter-verified ballot auditable trail. There are solutions. And in fact, for much of the stuff that's the most lurid and what we might call critical infrastructure, voting machines, electric grid, centrifuges in labs, those things are actually, as an intellectual matter, easier to secure than the open internet, where there might be all sorts of things we want to do with it, so we don't want to restrict it too much. But through our own laziness, we have not secured it. And I think that's shame on us. And we've boxed ourselves in because to call it critical infrastructure and summon the Department of Homeland Security to turn up at our local precinct there to help, we have such a trust deficit now, people will doubt that. They're going to be, wait, you're saying the last people to work on that voting machine was DHS? I don't trust that, they'll say.
Boxed in, why?
Boxed in because the very people that might be in a position to actually come in and try to secure the machines are people that the public or some segments of it also will not trust. So you have our own kind of declining trust in our military, in our intelligence agencies. That's a public trust deficit, makes it harder for them to take that step into the domestic sphere and say they're here to help. I think we ought to be dragooning some of the academics and others who've been beating the drum and are not sort of from the government to actually form a task force to help us secure that stuff.
We're going to rebuild this whole thing in the last 20 minutes of this conversation. But I also want to just throw out a sort of puzzle. Is the global nature of the web, which for me was originally a huge part of its charm and its realism in a new age, is the globalism itself sort of on the defensive in the era of Brexit, in the era of Trump, and the kind of remarshaling of national identity, and let's build some walls around this leaky net?
Well, that's a great question, because if we frame it with Brexit and populism, it may well be...
And nationalism and strongmanism and, take-chargeism.
But you could even see it, though, as a population wanting to communicate across borders in unity against the global elites. And in that sense, it's a cross-border sort of unity. But as you say, also, if there's a strong nationalist component to it, we've seen in China a partial embrace by the public of the idea of keeping foreign influence out, and that can even amount to a form of self-censorship. That's the kind of mortar that keeps the Great Firewall of China working better than it would if people were really eager to spend the extra time necessary to figure out a way around it. So I do detect among my colleagues a lot of pessimism about this one global great internet. At the same time, I wouldn't overstate it, because today there are more opportunities to have a message get out to a global audience, to communicate securely with other people, than there was a year ago or a year before that. So I'd want to watch the slope of that curve carefully to see if our anxieties are actually becoming true on this cantonization question.
I got to say, I'm so grateful for the web. I mean, I fell in love with the freedom of it, the non-commercial quality of it, the anti-imperial promise of it. I don't know what to make of the weapons that are living there now. Out of the DARPA history, you can't be totally shocked or even surprised. But are they going to crowd out that original lure that made open source possible?
Well, that's the most profound question in our space. It is, did we just undergo a 15-year period of hobbyist fun akin to the early days of radio before anybody noticed, grew up in a corner, some people had receivers, some other people had antennas and were off to the races, but then the Federal Radio Commission, later FCC, comes in to organize? Or are we just about to renew into another layer of growth and unpredictable contribution from many corners?
You've got the same problem I do. I mean, you remember when it was just kind of kids on Indian trails out there being ourselves, and suddenly it really is an information highway, and there are 18-wheel trucks, and some of them carrying, you know, huge missiles on their backs. It's worth fixing, and we're going to come back and do it with Sarah Watson. A 15-minute short course in re-architecting a safe, open, global network. This is Open Source. Nobody wants to say the internet promise was too good to be true, or that the commercialized web now being militarized is going to go away, only that it wasn't designed to carry the traffic it's now bearing, and it can look too chaotic to fix. Jeremy Allaire came out of McAllister College in Minnesota 2 decades ago, a web obsessive with a zeal to build internet platforms under the day-to-day exercise of human rights. He's been a serial entrepreneur ever since in web world, first moving videos, now moving Bitcoin and other definitions of digital money around Wall Street, around the side of Wall Street and traditional banks. Jeremy Allaire was a young star of the internet when it was virgin territory, the undeveloped Louisiana Purchase as of 1803. I asked him the other day, is the DNA of the web still there and still working?
We're in the early stages of essentially a new layer of the internet being built, and a layer of the internet that is designed to provide a way to allow any person in the world with a mobile phone or a computer to conduct a value exchange with any other person in the world instantly without respect to what currency they have or what country they're in, and to do that in a highly secure way and to do that without cost. In the same way that I can send a text message to anyone that has a mobile phone, or I can open up a WhatsApp chat with anyone in any
Skype call,
or a Skype call, or any of those examples that are over the top that basically replaced traditional media and communication services with free utilities for consumers that work everywhere, we're right on the cusp of that actually happening with how money moves around as money literally becomes digital in form. So it's a major new layer of the internet. It's being built in new technologies, by new companies, et cetera. And all the big traditional players, the big banks, et cetera, are scrambling to figure out, what does this mean? Is this going to take away their relationship to the customer? Is this going to undermine their underlying economics and things like that?
You got into it when the internet seemed to all of us kind of virgin territory. I thought it was the Louisiana Purchase. Unmined, it's got everything. You in a professional way, I in an amateur way, loved it. The DNA of the web was open, free, user-friendly, yeah. Not from Wall Street, not militarized, not even commercialized.
Right.
What's changed?
A lot has changed. The infrastructure itself has grown enormously. Like, what we can do with it, meaning I can have a video communication session with someone in China, and that's pretty powerful, and I can do that without paying a penny. I can search all the world's knowledge instantly for free. You know, that's pretty amazing. And that's because of that open model, right? Everyone can publish. It's almost, the cost of publishing is zero, effectively. And search and algorithms can surface that to you in incredible ways. So we have global, open, free communications. We have access to the world's knowledge.
We have a memory of it, but Vladimir Putin can rattle our confidence that our email is private, that our votes will be counted right.
Sure. You know, we're now really, as the stakes get higher, as this becomes, you know, important infrastructure in how the economy works, how money works, how education is delivered, how communications happens, all these things, we are seeing that original ethos of an open internet where, you know, we assume that humans are basically good and that people are going to treat each other with respect and not conduct various forms of attacks and crime. That's coming under attack, and it's coming under attack because it's becoming easier and easier for cyber criminals to conduct their work, and that can affect everybody from the individual consumer to the biggest corporations in the world to governments. But it's now obviously evolved to a place where states view it as part of their military toolkit and part of their espionage toolkit and part of their subterfuge toolkit, et cetera. And so in a much more pronounced way than I think we've seen in the past, there's this tension between the globalist ideals of the internet and this idea that we can have a open society globally and the idea that we can integrate our economies and our ideas and our cultures in an open, free-flowing way. That's being tested by nation states who would rather not have that be the case. That's a real challenge.
Brexit comes to the internet. I mean, it's fascinating how it picks up on the zeitgeist elsewhere.
That's right.
Nation states will do their own.
And this is, in a sense, I believe, the growth of the internet and the importance of the internet in society and the economy is in some ways very interlinked to the growth in globalization. In its positive ways, for the most part, you can talk about the dark side of it too, but you know, overall, we've got this more integrated world. And that's left people on the sidelines. It's opened up fears and wounds and the mobility of labor and other things have created tensions. And so the tensions that get created by globalization in some ways are mirrored on the internet.
That's Jeremy Allaire on the Bitcoin frontier at his company Circle. Sarah Watson joins us. She studied literature and film at Harvard, studied the internet at Oxford. She's written a provocative new piece in the Columbia Journalism Review on the mistakes that we amateurs make about technology. Sarah, we're going to ask you with Jonathan Zittrain to fix this little devil in the next 15, 20 minutes. Where do you begin?
I mean, I'm glad that Jonathan was talking about the importance of the war framing and the kind of ways we're framing and considering these questions, right? Because I think ultimately, the idea that we're talking about the cyber as a problem or as this kind of threat is really kind of acting on our baser fears about what's wrong here. So I think we're actually in this kind of pendulum moment between this long-term optimism about what the web, what was possible with the web, and this pessimism as a result of this like turning point, probably 2013 with Snowden, and kind of realizing, oh yes, we have gotten to that other point. But really, I think there has always been a piece of this underlying that. We kind of lean too much on the optimistic side and lean too far on the pessimistic side. So I think there's still a lot of room for either rebuilding it, but also kind of reframing how we're talking about it. And if we're leaving it to, you know, the Trumps of the world to say that, you know, the cyber threat is real.
Well, they're always trying to scare us at election time. But is there a worry there for you?
Yeah, I think it limits what we can begin to think is the problem, what we think is solvable. But I also think it's kind of pushing it into the realm of just kind of fear-mongering in general. And that's, you know, anything that's too polarized is really kind of missing the bigger picture and the nitty-gritty of like what's actually at stake.
What I celebrate and defines my fear is the quality of amateur, strong, good American conversation on that device. Some of it's heard, some of it's read, but it is a new world. Our pal Jim Moore called it the second superpower, and it raised its beautiful head, you know, in and around the Iraq War, and it's still doing it. Are we worried about that quality, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think, even we were talking about kind of the possibility to Skype or kind of have a video conversation with China, and that this kind of global fear or kind of concern is, you know, this balkanization of the internet, if you will.
That's a worry.
Yeah, right. But, you know, it used to be that global VPNs would work if you really cared about being in China. I've lived in China for a while. You know, the VPNs worked until they didn't. And now we're really kind of seeing those solutions kind of falling apart because they are now of the attention of superpowers who can kind of do that balkanization.
Jonathan, I want your punch list.
Okay.
Repairs, vital repairs.
All right, forthwith, a list of some of the biggest afflictions of the internet and what we should do to fix them.
Dr. Zittrain's making house calls. Go for it.
All right. First of all, the idea that the entire net can go down, so-called denial of service writ large because of a cyber bomb or the like, we have it in our power to build mesh networking. We can make it so that that iPhone or Android that would otherwise be useless if it doesn't get Wi-Fi from an access point or cell tower service for digital stuff, it can talk to nearby iPhones and Androids, which in turn talk to other nearby iPhones and Androids, and we've got a mesh in times of trouble when that hurricane hits the Florida coast. There is no reason we can't be doing this except for complacency and the idea that it only really becomes useful when the, quote, bomb hits, so we don't plan very well. Number two on my punch list, the idea of our critical infrastructure being attacked. And for that, I say, peel it off from the fun parts of the internet. Do what you need to do with a Manhattan Project to secure it. It really isn't rocket science. It takes money, it takes focus, and it's been in the Bush League B-level government contractor zone for too long. Next item on the punch list, sites can't stay online. They get denial of service attacks. We saw security researcher Brian Krebs get hit on his Akamai-hosted site, and Akamai is about as secure as you get, with 640 gigabits a second of traffic coming in. Akamai had to give up hosting our friend Brian. And what was generating the traffic? A network of hundreds of thousands of unsecured webcams in people's homes who had no idea the webcams had a second moonlighting job attacking Brian Krebs's site. That is generativity gone awry. It's the worst of both worlds. It's the public not able to really reprogram the cams, but a Russian hacker or whoever doing it.
Stick with generativity because it was a key word in your book on what's wrong or what's endangered on the web, which is to say initiative taking, originality, eccentricity, me being me on the web.
And the ability to accept contribution from any quarter, even if you don't have the right degree or certification or approval from some gatekeeper. If you can write code and people like it, then it wins. That quality we really need to be able to preserve and trust. And it's the kind of thing that Jeremy was excited about Bitcoin and the ledger and all sorts of things with that. That's because somebody sat down. We don't even know who. And came up with it, and it spoke for itself and became so prevalent.
I know Satoshi personally.
Sure wasn't.
But that kind of touches on, we haven't said the word decentralization, but I think one of the threats that is real and kind of present is the fact that the web that we now have is increasingly centralized. And that kind of increases the vulnerability of large entities and everything that we kind of started with, the idea that all of these entities were part of this larger network, we've kind of lost track of. And so there are larger targets now, and there's an opportunity to kind of re-decentralize what we originally visioned.
You got more on your list, Jonathan, but I want to just throw in one teeny tiny complaint, but it gets at a point about Facebook. Why can't we have an unlike button with the like button on Facebook and generate a more argumentative, combative, I don't mean combative, adversarial world around
we have six other emotions.
Let's have other emotions. But
what I say, it's amazing. We've become, again, so resigned to this. The idea that all we have is Facebook if we're going to do social networking seems nuts to me. It seems nuts to a lot of people, including, say, regulators in Europe. There is a solution to that. We saw an attempt to do an open source alternative like Diaspora, which didn't work out so well. But Facebook could be motivated itself to make it so that two kids in that garage could write their own algorithm to present you with your news feed. And instead of it just being Facebook chooses what you see, you could pick who your proxy will be. I'd like Ralph Nader to provide my feed, or I'd like Christopher Lydon to provide my feed. Facebook could make that happen, and I think it would do well even for itself if it enabled that kind of openness and generativity to take place. And
or at least gave users the opportunity to kind of fiddle with the levers, right? Right now, it's just Facebook is optimizing based on a lot of assumptions about what you're trying to do based on your previous behaviors. And that's really taking a lot for granted and making a lot of assumptions about what people want.
One more item on your list, Jonathan.
Well, one more item on my list would be to also recognize, even amidst all the gadgets and gizmos that are now internet-connected and how great that is, that at its core, cyberspace is, as my colleague Charlie Nesson says, a rhetorical space. Its most liberating fact is that it lets people communicate with each other and with great audiences that gather around their message that just couldn't have happened before. And figuring out how to preserve that quality while also dealing with the very real problem that right now, if you stick your neck out in a rhetorical community, you tweet the wrong thing, you can have legions of people trying to make your life hell. That's no way to run a railroad. And figuring out how to create a space where people feel free to express themselves and won't find themselves if they offend one or more people, it's all over. We need to deal with that.
I got to pull in a plug from my man, Ralph Waldo Emerson. I mean, it is an Emersonian, argumentative, self-reliant space. You know, follow the gleam in your own mind from within. Say it before somebody else does. Don't worry about consistency or conformity. Be yourself in the grand Emersonian way on the web. How many times have I said that? Where else to get advice? The epic biographer, Walter Isaacson, who did the life of Steve Jobs and before that of Benjamin Franklin. He blew through town for the MIT Summit on Cybersecurity this week. I asked him for the ancestral wisdom, especially of Franklin's, from the printer who ran our postal network from Massachusetts to Georgia in the 1770s.
Well, you know, Ben Franklin, first of all, believed that the free flow of information from people to people would bend the arc of history towards democracy, towards natural empowerment. That's why he runs away from Boston, which is, with all due respect to this wonderful town, then run by a theocracy that the Cotton Mather family, you know, controlled, to Philadelphia, where there are all sorts of people, and there's like 10 newspapers, and he starts an 11th newspaper. And he starts a system to send mail back and forth from Boston to Philadelphia, and soon he's created the entire colonial postal system. And he's very much into net neutrality. Everybody can use the postal system. Because if you tie together America with the free flow of information, he felt, we will be in a better place. In the end, when they're doing the Constitutional Convention in that very hot room in Philadelphia, they decide to close the doors. They decide to say, it's best that we have some zone of confidentiality and allow people to talk. Even at the First Continental Congress, if you're on that committee to draft the Declaration of Independence, you're not actually sure you want to do it in public because you will get hanged. So he would like to see the free flow of information protect people speaking, but he also believed that in the end you had to take responsibility for your words. And that total anonymity you could never count on. In fact, when they go to sign the Declaration of Independence, and John Hancock signs it in big letters, they say, you know, we may hang. And he says, well, we'll either all hang separately or we should all hang together. Let's all sign this document. The notion between our zones of privacy and confidentiality, the needs of transparency, they've been with us for a long time. The problem is technology is changing so fast now, it's outpacing our ability to grapple with it, even in this conversation.
And back before Benjamin Franklin, your next subject, Leonardo, everybody's ultimate designer. What's his wisdom on the internet?
You know, what he believed is in the connection of technology to the humanities. He wasn't just a tech engineer, obviously, because he paints the Mona Lisa, but he wasn't just an artist. He's somebody who invents all sorts of devices. And I think the lesson for the next phase of our revolution is that we have to reconnect the humanities to our technology. And there's no better symbol of that than Vitruvian Man, you know, that nude guy doing jumping jacks in the circle in the square that Leonardo did in his notebooks, both as a piece of art and as a piece of science.
Thank you, Walter Isaacson, and Jonathan Zittrain, Sarah Marie Watson, Richard Clark, Jeremy Allaire, and Alex Gibney. Our Cyber Command is led by Connor Gillies, Frank Horton, Zach Goldhammer, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our pilot. Mary McGrath is our hacker-in-chief. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.